Okay, so we are on Sadi Ches Amud Beis, everybody knows, and it's relatively easy to identify where we are up to, because if you look at the daf, we are up to the first line where the lines begin to get wider. Amar Rav Gido, right in the middle of the line after the period. Everybody have it? Okay, with me? Okay, thank you, Rebecca, for posting the Safaria link. Amar Rav Gidol, Amar Rav. Rav Gidol said in the name of Rav, Asidin Yisrael, the Achle Shnei Mashiach. In the future, Bnei Yisrael will eat of the benefits of the surplus of the wealth of the years of Mashiach. They will derive satisfaction from all the good things that happen in the Messianic era. Got it? What's the obvious question? Who else is supposed to benefit from Mashiach? I mean, other than Bnei Yisrael. The Mashiach is supposed to save Bnei Yisrael from all of its tzaras and difficulty. And so what's Rav Gidol, in the name of Rav, teaching us? Oh, look at this great chiddush. Do you know who's going to benefit from Yemos HaMashiach? It's the Jewish people. Duh. What, who would have thought otherwise? Right? It's an obvious question. You with me, everybody? I'm not seeing too many faces, but it's kind of an obvious question. So that's actually the Gemara's question. And the Gemara asks that question, Rav Yosef in particular, and he asks it in a just such a wonderful kind of comic way. And, you know, generally speaking, our Gemara is very sober-minded, as Gemaras frequently, although not exclusively, are. But we get a kind of a lighthearted comment, because the question is just so, I mean, the claim was just so odd. So here's what Rav Yosef says. Amar Rav Yosef, Pshita. Of course, it's obvious that the Jews are going to benefit from Yemos HaMashiach. Belamanachil, who otherwise would eat and benefit from the surplus, the satisfaction of Yemos HaMashiach? Chilek ubilek achiluhu? Are Chilek and Bilek supposed to be the ones who eat this? So, you will ask, who are Chilek and Bilek? But just notice the form of the Gemara's question. And this is so classically Jewish, and of course it's partially classically Jewish because we get this going back to the Gemara, and maybe some other reasons too. Gemara adds the question with, in other words, it's like the way the Gemara, it's almost a humorous jive. Well, who else is supposed to eat it? Chilek or Bilek? Like, who do you expect is going to eat it? So who are this Chilek or Bilek? Like, who does that, you know, when's the last time anybody heard the name is Chilek or Bilek? Who are they? It's not exactly very well known. So it's actually, if you look at Rashi, this is a very unusual phrase. One doesn't find this in the Gemara. So the Mefarshim will try to figure out who this Chilek or Bilek are. Rashi says, if you look at Rashi, see Rashi, left-hand column of the two columns on the side of the Gemara, left-hand column, second, first line in the top. Ela chilek ubilek achli lahu. Kacha yiragilim lomar. That's what they used to say. It would be as if somebody said, who's supposed to eat it, Joe Schmo? It was names that are like silly names. But not quite silly, as we'll see, but that's the idea. The Gemara is kind of making fun of it. But who else is supposed to eat it? Joe Schmo? Who do you expect is going to eat it? Bnei Yisrael. But Rashi then refines that a little bit. Ka'adam sha'omer, as if somebody were to say, v'chi shedim v'shadosos yochlu, would demons eat it? And in fact, that's the way some afarshim translate chilek ubilek, as names of demons. So I think this is sort of humorous. Like, who's supposed to eat it? The ghosts? But I think there may be a little more to it than that. Can you see any reason yourselves why the Gemara might have posed the question in that way? Like, who's supposed to eat it? The demons? And how does a Jew look at those who persecute us? They're demons. And so the Gemara kind of says it in a joking way, but as is not infrequently with the case with jokes, the jokes sometimes penetrate through to a deeper truth. And the deeper truth here is that the jokey way, like Joe Schmo, who's going to eat it, is really a way of saying, who's going to eat it? The people who persecute us, the demons who persecute us, of course they're not going to eat it. The whole point of Mashiach is to save us from the persecutors. So it's a kind of a joke, but the joking language, I would say, masks a certain deeper truth. Rashi then cites another interpretation a couple of lines down. These are words of destruction. Who's going to eat it? Is it going to be destroyed? Is some destroyer going to eat it? So that's another way of reading it. And then another interpretation that Rashi cites, and other Mepharshim say, is that these are the names. If you look at the last line of that Rashi, sort of going down about 8 or 9 lines, Lishna Achrina, you see that the Lamed Aleph? Lishna Achrina, Chileg Ubileg Beis Dayanei Stom. Shahayu Shmosehem Kach. The names of two judges in stone were called Chilek and Bilek. Now, where does that tradition come from? Like, how are we supposed to know the names of two judges of stone? And I don't know the answer to that question. This must be some tradition going way back that the authors of this interpretation had access to. But what do you think is the significance of that? Again, why mention the two judges of stone of all places? Yes, Howard? You're unmuted, Howard.
Sorry, thank you. Normally people say that to the victor goes the spoils. And I think what the Gemara is saying is there ain't gonna be any spoils. It's going to be a total destruction. There will be nothing left and no benefit, like, you know, in Hollow or Shehem B'Shtakavim Lehevel L'Rik, that there will not be anything that remains of value to them by destroying us at that time. You know, after the Churban, they took away the menorah to the Rome, and so they have the spoils of the Ark and things. And in this case, immediately after this, there'll be nothing left. They won't gain anything by destroying us, and there'll be nothing of ours. That's good that we may, well, and after this terrible process.
Okay, I hear that, but that explains the Churba, the interpretation. It doesn't go to the two judges of stone, which is a whole other reading. I think that the idea is kind of similar. Stone epitomizes evil, and those who persecute the Jews, from whom the Mashiach is supposed to, or against whom the Mashiach is supposed to defend us, they are personified as two judges of stone, awful, awful people. It's interesting that specifically judges. Why not just two generals of stone, or two soldiers, or two executioners of stone? Why specifically judges? So think about this. I think it's, to my mind, it's pretty interesting. Why specifically the judges of stone? Think back maybe 70 or 80 years.
Nuremberg trials?
Well, a little before that, the Holocaust. Many of the most erudite and elite members of Nazi society were amongst the most vicious anti-Semites, including the leaders of the judiciary who approved the laws that discriminated against the Jews. I think this is a brilliantly prescient comment on the part of Rashi, this interpretation, that some of our worst persecutors are the judges. Some of our worst persecutors are supposed to be exemplars of justice and virtue, and they are the ones from whom the Mashiach must protect us. It's a remarkable, why the judges of stone? Why not the soldiers, executioners, or generals? The fact that it's the judges of stone, to my mind, the Gemara, at least in this interpretation, is alluding to the ways in which an anti-Semitic society can be corrupt, and the corruption penetrates to the very intellectual elite of that society. And in fact, those people in society who are charged with seeing to it that justice is done, and these are the very ones who pervert justice. The Dayanim of stone, not the regular citizens or the soldiers. So it's a remarkable, I mean, who would have, that's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. And it's amazing how Gemara seems to allude, according to this interpretation, seems to allude to exactly that phenomenon. So I find that kind of breathtaking, if you think about it, at least the way I read it. I mean, there is this ancient tradition, which apparently these sources cite. This is the Aruch, who cited in the name of Rabbeinu Gershom. It's a very early source. Where he got it, I don't know. Doesn't say anywhere, as far as I know. But to my mind, it's a quite a brilliant interpretation in its own way. In any case, let's get back to our Gemara. The Gemara cited, to refresh your memory, Rav Gidol, the name of Rav's teaching, that the Jews will benefit from Imos HaMashiach. The Gemara is now asking, well, that seems like a silly comment. Who else is going to benefit? And let's look at the Gemara's answer. The Chiddush, the novum of Rav's teaching is, La'afukein midrabbi Hillel, to exclude the teaching of Rav Hillel, the Amar, who said, Ein Mashiach li Israel, there will be no future Mashiach to the Jewish people, Shekvar achaluhu bibei Chizkiyo. Chizkiyo was to have been the Mashiach, but he was a failed Mashiach, and he did not succeed, and kaput. There goes the institution of Mashiach. According to Rav Hillel, at least on the usual or simple way of hearing Rav Hillel's teaching, all of the amun that Klal Yisrael has for the Ani Malin, Amuna Shlema, Vias HaMashiach, Yafal Pishi Yismamea, we hope and pray and wait for the Mashiach. Rav Hillel, that's all misbegotten hope. The Mashiach will never come. Now that's pretty disturbing teaching. Obviously it is a Das Yachid, is not exactly a popular point of view. And I'm not going to analyze it now because here it's mentioned just on the side, whereas the main teaching of Hillel, where the Gemara discusses it a little bit, is in the next daf. We're on Sadi Ches Amud Beis, that's Sadi Tes Amud Aleph. So I'm going to hold in abeyance an analysis of Rav Hillel's teaching until we get to the locus classicus, the main place where it's discussed, and that is on the next daf. So if you can hang on, we'll take it then. I see a couple of comments on chat. According to the Rambam, would he have been a kofar, a pure kfira? So actually, there are Rishonim, medieval thinkers, who maintain that Rambam's codification of the 13 principles of faith must be wrong in some points, because after all, Hillel, who was cited by the Gemara and is an authority, takes this position, and so couldn't be that according to the Rambam, or couldn't be, that somebody of Hillel's stature could be an apikoros, could be a kofar. And so Michael and Alex, both of your point, now Michael in particular, really plays into an extended medieval discussion about Rambam's formulation of the Yud Gimel Ikare Amuna, where our Ani Manu Amuna Shlema ultimately derives from. So again, let's hold that in abeyance. See if you could check it at the door, and let's return to a fuller discussion of Hillel's teaching when we get to it, which is not so far away. It's on the next off. I want to kind of hew more closely to the theme of our Gemara. So hang on. Maybe that will inspire you to continue to come to our shiur until we get to it. It's only on the next stop, but it is definitely a very controversial position. And Rav Gidol cited Rav, who was telling us, no, Hillel is wrong, because, in fact, there will be benefit to the Jewish people with the coming of the Mashiach. How good an answer that is to the question posed about Rav's teaching is unclear to me, because it doesn't sound like, if that's what Rav meant to say when saying that the Jews will benefit from the Mashiach, why didn't he just say the Mashiach is going to come? Rav doesn't say the Mashiach is going to come, and that would be a denial of Hillel's teaching. Rav says it's the Jews who will benefit from the Mashiach. So he seems to be focusing on Jewish versus non-Jewish benefit. So the Gemara's answer, to my mind, is troubling, and I'm not sure, or at least problematic. I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. And an alternative reading of Rav, which the Gemara does not provide, and so therefore it's obviously suspect, but an alternative reading of Rav could relate to the theme that we discussed, and there was a lot of controversy surrounding it last week, and that is the universalistic versus the particularistic elements of the Jewish tradition. We talked about how Rav Yochanan said earlier that Hashem will feel pained in saving the Jewish people from the Mashiach, from persecution, because that would mean dispossessing the non-Jews who possessed Eretz Yisrael. Remember that? We talked about that last week, and some people were troubled by that teaching, although actually it wasn't troubling for those who are of a more universalistic bent, because certainly Rav Yochanan was stressing that universalistic bent. It could be Rav Gidol is also operating in that same universalistic universe. And just like for Rav Yochanan, Hashem was troubled by the need to dispossess, to drive out Gentile occupiers of Eretz Yisrael in order to bring Jews back into Eretz Yisrael. And they are, as Rav Yochanan said, Ma'ase Yadai, they are the creatures of Hashem, just like the Jewish people. Remember, we talked about that last week. So it could be Rav and Rav Gidol are operating in the same theme, and they're saying, no, it really is true that the Jews will benefit from the Mashiach. And you might think otherwise, because after all, they're all Ma'ase Yadai. And here's the rub. Might one not make the following claim? Think about this, everybody. That is it not possible, with the advent of the Mashiach, that all of humankind will be equally redeemed, and therefore all of humankind will equally benefit from the Mashiach? Is that not possible? And by the way, that's the Christian position. Of course, you have, for Christians, you have to accept belief in the Messiah, in their Messiah, in order to be redeemed, so it's not so universalistic in that sense, but the idea that the Mashiach could redeem the entire universe equally, following from the universalistic theme that we have been tracking and discussing, might be an explanation for Rav's Chiddush. Even though the Mashiach will redeem the entire world, nevertheless, the primary benefactors, the primary material benefactors, beneficiaries of the Mashiach will be Bnei Yisrael. That's the Chiddush. The Chiddush is that it's not, that even though everybody is created at Tzelem Elokim, nevertheless, the Gentiles who occupy the land will be dispossessed, and nevertheless, Jews will be the primary beneficiaries of the Mashiach. But it's all revolving around this universalistic, particularistic tension, and that's, and Rav was troubled by it, in the same way that his contemporary, Rabbi Yochanan, was troubled by it. Rabbi Yochanan lived in Eretz Yisrael. Rav was a rough contemporary, a little older than Rabbi Yochanan, but a rough contemporary of Rabbi Yochanan, teaching and living in Bavel. And both of them were on this reading that I'm suggesting of Rav's teaching, both of them were struggling with this universalistic versus particularistic theme. And in both cases, the Chiddush is, yes, in fact, the Jews are better, even though they're kind of troubled by that in some way. Now, that to my mind is a plausible reading of Rav. The main problem with it is that the Gemara doesn't say it. The Gemara provides another reading. So the Rav Yosef is rejecting Sokol's interpretation of Rav. And I take that pretty seriously because Rav Yosef is Rav Yosef. So I leave you with that to ponder, but bracketing for a moment Rav Yosef's later interpretation of Rav, that's an interpretation that speaks to me based upon the context of the Gemara. Okay, so that's my little read. Howard, you had your hand up?
It's possible that it's a response to Rav Yochanan saying, I be around for the Mashiach is so terrible that then led people to say, well, what's the benefit of Mashiach then? If those terrible things are all going to happen, they're going to pull out the coffins, you know, with the law. You know, people were questioning, is it really good for the Jews? Yeah, you know, is it really worth it? And this is a response to saying that it's.
No, hang on a second, Howard. Rabbi Yochanan never doubted or never expressed any doubt about the benefit of the Messianic era. It's the process that disturbed him. You don't want to be right at the process. But I don't think he questioned the issue that the Jews would benefit. Okay, so, you know, it's an interesting thing. Remember, Yosef is coming later than Rav. He's a much later Amora, and this is his way of interpreting Rav. Obviously, it takes precedence over Sokol, who's like quite a bit later than Rav, and has no authority, unlike Rav Yosef, who's a great, 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 great Amora. But nevertheless, you know, the Gemara is there for us to learn, so I kind of like just throw that out for you to think about. Any comments or questions about that? I don't see anything on the chat about that in particular. Nope. Okay, so let us then proceed. Amar Rav, now we're on the first line of the widest lines of the daf. Another teaching of Rav, an interesting and important one. Amar Rav, lo ivrei alma ela ledavid. Everybody with me? The whole world is worthy of having been created merely because of David HaMelech. David HaMelech's greatness was such as to render worthwhile the entire creation of the universe. A more precise translation would be the world was created only for David. I think it means more broadly speaking, that's what makes the results worthwhile. The result, the creation worthwhile. Shmuel Amar Lemoshe. Shmuel, disagreeing with Rav, maintains that the purpose of the creation or what makes the world worthwhile was not David HaMelech, but it was Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, and Rabbi Yochanan said, the Mashiach. What makes the world worthwhile is the Mashiach. So what are they debating? Like, what's that all about? So, a good place to begin to answer that question is Rashi. So, Rashi is Ella Ladovid. It's about 10 lines from where the lines in Rashi begin to get narrow. Hopefully you can find it. If not, I'll just read it. Ella Ladovid b'schus David. The world is worthy of having been created in the merit of David. Shaya asid lomar kama shiros v'tushbachos. He would in the future author Tehillim and sing songs and praises of Hashem. The Moshe. So Shmuel says, no, not David makes the world worthwhile, but Moshe. And what is Moshe? B'shvil Moshe shall yo'osid l'kabel es ha'tolah. So the debate between Rav and Shmuel is what makes the world worthwhile? Is it a person who is capable of authoring the Tehillim and singing beautiful songs and praises to Hashem? Or is it the person responsible for bringing Torah to the world? This is really not an insignificant machlokas. What's the most important thing a human being can do? Is it to be so spiritually and poetically inspired as to sing, create beautiful songs of praise to Hashem? Or is it the study of Torah? Or to oversimplify this, is it to be a chassid or is it to be a litvak? Is it this poetry of the soul? I'm not talking necessarily about today's chassidim, but the earliest chassidim, you think about the spirituality, the fervor, the intensity, especially those chassidim of the rebbes who were capable of singing these beautiful songs of praise to Hashem. Is it the ruach or is it the moach? Is it the spirit of singing praises to Hashem, being inspired just to burst out in song, being touched by Hashem's presence? Or is it Torah, which is the study of Torah and knowing how to guide our lives cognitively and behaviorally? Because the Torah is two dimensions. It's a cognitive dimension, knowing what's right, what is Hashem's command, and be following it. So the Misnagdim were anti the Hasidim because they felt that all of that intense spirituality might lead to a departure from studying Torah and the rigorous following of halacha. They felt that there were certain Hasidic practices which violated the halacha, like, for example, davening after the Zman. The Rebbe's, early Rebbe's, and to this day, in fact, especially the early Rebbe's, they missed the Zman Tefillah because they were so, you know, inspiring themselves and inspiring and developing that spirituality and closeness to Hashem. I'll give it time, okay, another 15 minutes, another 2 minutes, like what's so important? Let's build up that hislavus, that spirit. And then Stagdim said, hey, what is this? It's a Shulchan Aruch. You get the spirit. Let's do the right thing. So, I mean, as I say, to kind of oversimplify, one way to read this machlokas between Rav and Shmuel is a machlokas as to what is the most important, the spiritual capacity to sing songs to Hashem in its elevated state, or Torah, 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 Torah. So it's not an inconsequential machlokas, to my mind. With me, everybody? Now, what's with the Mashiach? What is Rabbi Yochanan's position? Rabbi Yochanan, remember, is the one who said, I don't want to live at the time of the Mashiach. And the Gemara's explanation was for that was that he didn't want to be party to the ejection of Gentiles from the Eretz Yisrael because they are also the creatures of Hashem. So Rabbi Yochanan, who said that, on the other hand, said the whole purpose of creation is the Mashiach. So how do you understand Rabbi Yochanan? How is he disagreeing with Rav and Shmuel? Like, what's his shita? What is his approach? If Shmuel is about song and Rav is about Torah, then what is Rabbi Yochanan about? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Yes, Joe, of course, you need both. The question is, which has priority? Which is most important? Yes, both enhance, each enhances the other. You're absolutely right. The question is, which is the most important? Just like the Hasidim mentions, at least early Hasidim stressed davening more than learning, and the Litvak or Misnagdim stressed learning more than davening. It's not that they missed, the Misnagdim didn't daven. It's not that the Hasidim didn't learn, but there's a difference. Well, anyway, anybody want to help out with understanding, interpreting Rabbi Yochanan's position? Why the Mashiach? So who is speaking now?
Yes, this is Michael.
Hi, Klein. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
So could it be the David and Moshe represent the past and Mashiach represents the future? So could this be an argument about whether the past versus the future? Just laying that out as a possibility.
Very interesting thought. I like that. It's an interesting angle. It doesn't speak specifically to what the Mashiach represents, though. I mean, the future is very vague. The future could also mean who knows what. I think you're right about that, but I don't think it goes far enough. I think we need to identify something specific about the Mashiach in addition to or beyond his living in the future rather than in the past. Howard? Where's everybody today? Everybody asleep today? I don't know. Howard's awake. I got Michael, but where's everybody else? Yes, Howard. You're muted.
Thank you for defaulting to me. I appreciate. Does it go back to the particularistic versus universalistic, where the Moshe and David refer to the Jews, and Mashiach refers to everybody in the world will recognize that God is the King of the world. So that
excellent, excellent. That's exactly the way I would read it. Remember, even though the Mashiach will primarily benefit the Jewish people, but nevertheless, the entire world will recognize Hashem. Remember, so much of the Nevuah speaks about how the Gentiles will come and they will bring karbanos to Hashem, and everybody will recognize that Hashem is Melech Olam. That's the tefillah of the Yom Narayim, the symbol, the entire universe will come to accept Hashem's sovereignty. So whereas the Shiros, which is Bachos of David, they were unique to the Jewish people, as was the Torah. Only the Jews accepted the Torah. But the Mashiach is a universal transformation. It transforms the entire world, in which the Malchus of Hashem, the sovereignty of Hashem, becomes recognized by every creature. And the entire universe is changed. Now, the Torah changed primarily the Jewish people. Obviously, it has a huge impact on all of Western civilization, no question about it. But it was primarily directed at the Jews, at Har Sinai. And of course, the Shiros v'Tishbachos, Tehillim, had an impact on the entire world, not just Jews. But nevertheless, it was David who sang it primarily for the Jewish people. It just so happened that the books got published and other people read it. But he was singing in the context of the limited Jews who lived at his time and his day and his location. But Mashiach is a universally transformative time in which the whole world will be a better world for it. And yeah, so I think definitely one way to read this is Rabbi Yochanan in this context was a universalist, and Howard is probably alluding to this. This is exactly the Rabbi Yochanan who said before that he was pained over how Gentiles will need to be displaced from Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Yochanan has this universalistic sensibility, which is why he's pained over the displacement. And therefore, he more than anybody would advocate or speak to the universalistic mission of the Messianic era. So he is l'shitato, as they say. He is following his own way of thinking consistently throughout. So I think that's one very plausible way to read it. And I'm reading Michael. David represents tefillah, Moshe represents Torah, Mashiach represents chesed. Torah, avoda, and gemilas chesedim. Okay, that's interesting. Chesed. Interesting, very interesting idea, Michael. Although if you look at, let's say, the Rambam's description of the Mashiach in the Messianic era. And I wanted to return to this point. Well, I'll come to it right now. But let me just respond to Michael's lovely suggestion. The descriptions of the Mashiach are not primarily those of a Gomel Chesed. The Mashiach is usually described in Chazal, in the Vim, insofar as he appears, as a Melech HaMashiach. Melech HaMashiach. He's a king. He vanquishes our enemies, and he brings Jews and the Torah and Hashem into the entire universe. But the Mashiach is a political, military figure more than, I would say, a Chesed figure. And I think that one way of understanding why the Mashiach is so important is that for the first time in world history, we will have a political leader who as a result of his power and authority and victories transforms the world. It's not just universalistic, which is the first point I made. I'm adding another wrinkle to it, which is that it is the political redemption of the world. Instead of having people fighting with each other and one nation fighting with this nation in wars and battles, we will have a single king whose vision will shape the entire world, and there will be peace in the world. There won't be wars. There will be, the world will be much better. So there is a chesed element, but it's not primarily chesed. It's primarily optimal political leadership, which leads to a reign of peace and happiness and productivity and an overall reorganization of society. And so what I'm driving at is that if Moshe is Torah and David is Shiros Hashbachos, the Mashiach is political. That it is the political trend. It is the culmination of a politic, of a polis, of a society governed by a good person who transforms the world. So there is poetry, Torah, and optimal political leadership that changes the world. We live in a political era right now. Elections and been a very political time, obviously. The new president will soon be inaugurated. And it's hard not to think politically. And the Mashiach was a political figure. If you look at the Rambam and Hilchos Malachim, definitely described in very political, military, and very political terms. And that's another way of thinking about it. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a leader of the world inspired by Hashem who brought peace? Political ideal. That's another way of thinking about Rabbi Yochanan's teaching, and I find that as well pretty compelling.